Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Druid Path, a Modern Tradition of Nature Spirituality by John Michael Greer, narrated by Ian M. Hawkins. Publisher's Note: This audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit tantor.com and type The Druid Path into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then, under the supplemental content section, please enter the access code RITUAL, and then click the unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters. All diagrams and tables referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. This publication includes alternative therapies that have not been scientifically tested, is intended for informational purposes only, and is not intended to provide or replace conventional medical advice, treatment, or diagnosis, or be a substitute to consulting with licensed medical or healthcare providers. The publisher does not claim or guarantee any benefits, healing, cure, or any results in any respect, and shall not be liable or responsible for any use or application of any content in this publication in any respect, including, without limitation, any adverse effect, consequence, loss, or damage of any type resulting or arising from, directly or indirectly, any use or application of any content herein. Introduction. Most people these days have heard of druids, even if the only things they know about the subject come from news photos of summer solstice celebrations at Stonehenge, the white-robed figure of Getafix in the French comic Asterix the Gaul, or one of the character classes in the World of Warcraft online role-playing game. Even in these dim, reflected forms, the image of the druid, wise in the ways of nature, haunts the imagination of our time. What many people have never realized is that druids exist here and now, and that druidry, the spiritual path practiced by druids, is an option even for those who live in a modern industrial society. The original druids lived many centuries ago in the Celtic countries of northwestern Europe, where Ireland, Great Britain, and France are located today. 300 years ago, in the early years of the Industrial Revolution, their example and the surviving records of their traditions inspired small groups of creative thinkers to begin the process of creating a druidry for today. The movement they set in motion, the Druid Revival, as it has been called, has flourished ever since. Originally founded in England, modern druidry spread to Europe, North America, and Australia before the 19th century was finished. Druids today can be found in countries all around the world. My own introduction to druidry happened more than a quarter century ago. In 1993, a good friend of mine introduced me to one of his friends, the late Corby Ingold, who was a druid, a member of the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, OBOD. Then, as now, the largest druid organization in the world. Corby and I hit it off immediately. After learning more about druidry from him, I decided to join OBOD. I was initiated as a bard by Corby and the other members of his Druid Grove on May 1, 1994, and passed step by step through OBOD's distance learning program thereafter, receiving my certificate as a druid companion in 2002. By then, I knew that I had found my spiritual home. As the final steps of the OBOD training course drew near, I went looking for other resources to expand my knowledge and understanding of druidry. A battered paperback on American druid groups I found at a used bookstore mentioned another order, the Ancient Order of Druids in America, AODA, and gave an address that turned out to be outdated. When I finally managed to track down the order's secretary, I found out that the AODA was clinging to existence with fewer than a dozen members, all well past retirement age. I asked to join. They accepted. Conversations followed, and that was how, on the winter solstice of 2003, I became the 7th Grand Archdruid of AODA, tasked with the project of reviving an almost extinct druid order. The 12 years I spent thereafter as head of AODA were among the busiest and most rewarding of my life. The short version of what happened is that, with the help of many other people, I succeeded. AODA is now among the largest and most active druid orders in the world, with members all over North America and on several other continents as well. My duties as Grand Archdruid left me very little spare time, however. It was only after I passed my office on to my successor in 2015 and settled into the much less demanding role of Archdruid Emeritus that I had the freedom to take a broader look at modern druidry and begin to consider other ways to share the things I have learned about the druid tradition. This book is one of the results. The chapters before you are a portal. If you decide to pass through that portal, you will join in a quest for ancient wisdom that has been going on for 300 years. The paths that have been marked out by the seekers who have gone before you lead past standing stones and grass-covered mounds, through deep forests and green meadows, to your own backyard and the landscape that surrounds you right now. Will you follow those paths and join in the quest? Only you can decide. Part 1. The Sources of Druidry. Druidry is a modern tradition of nature spirituality. While its roots go back to ancient times, the history of druidry in its present form goes back only as far as the 18th century. No one person founded it, nor was there a single organization that started the modern druid movement on its way. Instead, it emerged gradually, over the course of many years, as individuals and small circles of friends began to explore the possibility of a vision of reality that embraced the presence of spirit in nature. Is druidry a religion? For some people it can be. For others, it is better described as a philosophy, a practice, or a way of life. Some druids take part in a religious tradition apart from druidry, or combine their druidry with their religion in various ways. There have been Christian druids, for example, since the earliest days of the modern druid movement, and there have been pagan druids for just as long. Others, many of whom consider themselves spiritual but not religious, find the druid path all by itself sufficient for their needs. What if you don't know what you believe? That's fine too, as long as you are open to the possibility that the world is more than a random collection of lumps of dead matter in empty space, and that purpose and meaning and consciousness are present throughout the world of nature, druidry is an option for you. Above all else, druidry is an orientation, a way of attending to the spiritual in natural things, of envisioning humanity as part of living nature and of living life in relationship to the biosphere and the spiritual presences within the natural world. Each druid expresses that orientation in a personal way. Books, teachers, and organizations can help you find your way in druidry. That is the purpose of this book. But your own experiences and ideas are also important. If you're looking for someone to tell you what to do, druidry is probably not a good fit for you. And if you want to tell other people what to do, then you really need to find some other option, because druids are an independent-minded lot and will roll their eyes and walk away if you try to order them around. To become a druid is to take part in an adventure that has been unfolding for 300 years and still has unexplored regions ahead of it. The concepts, teachings, and practices given in this book are meant to help you take the first steps in your druid journey. White robes and golden sickles. When many people think of druids, what comes to mind first is very often an image of old men in white robes carrying golden sickles to Stonehenge. The druid Getafix from the comic series Asterix the Gaul is a fine parody of this image, and one that many modern druids enjoy. The origins of this image are complicated. One of the few accounts of the ancient druids that gives any details of their clothing and equipment describes them as wearing white robes and using a golden sickle to harvest mistletoe from oak trees. In the 18th century, when the druid tradition was revived, some of the people involved in that revival took to wearing white robes in honor of the ancient druids. Others went in their own direction. In one 18th century druid group, for example, the participants wore ordinary clothing but tied bits of colored ribbon around their right arms. The color showed how far they had proceeded in the process of studying and practicing druidry. Nowadays, as with so much else, it depends on the druid. Some druids like to wear the classic style of white robe, though I have yet to see an actual golden sickle in use among druids. Given the price of gold these days, one of these would be very expensive. Others wear different colors of robes or other ceremonial garments, and plenty of druids simply dress in ordinary clothing suited to the weather. There are spiritual traditions that place a great deal of emphasis on having the right clothes, the right symbols, the right ritual objects, and so on. Druidry is not one of them. You can certainly equip yourself with a white robe and a sickle if that's what you want, and some modern druid organizations and books encourage you to make or buy certain other pieces of equipment that will be useful for your druid work. But there are only two things that are essential to study and practice druidry: yourself and the universe you live in. Chapter 1. The Ancient Druids. To understand the roots of modern druidry, it helps to begin by looking into the distant past. Imagine for a moment that you were able to travel back in time more than 2,000 years to ancient northwestern Europe, the regions where the countries of Ireland, Great Britain, and France are located today. The people who lived in that part of the world back then belonged to many small tribes and spoke variants of a common language. For food, they grew wheat and barley, raised cows, pigs, and sheep, gathered nuts and wild plants from the forest, hunted wild game, and caught fish. They lived in scattered villages of houses that were dug partly into the ground to help keep them warm in winter and cool in summer. They worshipped many gods and goddesses, celebrated a complex calendar of local feasts and ceremonies, and loved music, poetry, and stories. They fought among themselves, their chieftains riding chariots pulled by ponies, their young men on foot with spears, swords, and big shields. The great discoveries that were already reshaping life in distant lands farther south and east, writing, cities, and more, had not yet reached them. They were the ancient Celts, and it was among them that the druids first appeared. No one knows where that first and oldest version of druidry came from. It might have been created by the ancient Celts themselves. It might have been passed down from the people who lived in those lands before the Celts got there, the forgotten nations that built Stonehenge and the other stone circles of those lands. It might have come from somewhere else. We simply don't know. What we do know is that when travelers from Greece and Rome reached the Celtic lands of northwestern Europe, living among the tribal peoples there, they found druids, men and women who devoted their lives to wisdom. These druids knew the powers of herbs and stones and the rhythms of planets and stars. They composed poems, recited myths and tribal histories, and passed on wisdom teachings to those who wanted to learn from them. The druids weren't priests and priestesses. The travelers who came to the Celtic lands had plenty of priests and priestesses back home, and never used those terms for the Druids. The name these seekers of wisdom used for themselves probably meant Wise Ones of the Oaks in the Welsh language, which is descended from the ancient Celtic tongue. Druid is Derwith, from Deru, oak, and Gwith, with when combined with another word, is an old term for wisdom or knowledge. Young men and women who wanted to become Druids went to study with an experienced Druid. Since none of the Druid teachings were ever written down, all of it had to be memorized, and it took some students 20 years to learn everything they needed to know to become Druids. Once they completed their studies, they no longer took part in tribal warfare, and they devoted their time to teaching and to their duties as Druids. Some married and raised families, while others did not. The wisest and most learned Druids often became advisors to kings, but many others lived much humbler lives, living and working in a single small village, teaching children, healing the sick, and performing ceremonies for the people. That was how things were when the Romans began their campaigns of conquest in northwestern Europe. The Celtic warriors fought bravely, but Roman military technology and organization made it a hopeless fight. During the long struggle, Druids took a leading role in coordinating the resistance, and the Romans responded by outlawing Druidry and killing a great many Druids. In the countries that Rome conquered, today's France, Brittany, England, and Wales, Druids survived only in secret, and many of them had to find other ways to support themselves. Centuries after the conquest, one Roman writer mentions a Druid who worked as an innkeeper. In the Celtic lands that stayed outside Rome's grasp, today's Scotland and Ireland, Druids remained active for centuries longer. What finally put an end to the ancient Druids was the coming of Christianity. Elsewhere in the ancient world, Christians and pagans went after each other in waves of violent persecution. While very little of that ever took place in ancient Scotland and Ireland, Christian missionaries who came to those lands had learned to distrust all spiritual traditions outside their own churches. Gradually, under pressure from Celtic tribal chieftains, the Christian clergy and the Druids worked out a wary compromise. Those Druids who didn't become Christian priests, monks, and nuns, as some did, became bards instead, using their knowledge of myths and tribal histories and their skill with poetic verse to support themselves and preserve some of their traditions. Over the generations that followed, while the legends of the Celts were preserved by the bards, most of the other teachings of Druidry were lost, and the Druids themselves became a fading memory. More than 1,000 years would pass before Druids would emerge again from the realms of legend. Mistletoe. One of the most detailed descriptions of the ancient Druids comes from the Roman writer Pliny the Elder, who put an account of a Druid ceremony in the pages of his book Natural History. According to Pliny, the Druids considered mistletoe, a parasitic plant that grows on trees, a holy healing plant. They believed it was especially sacred and medicinally effective when it appeared on an oak, which happened very rarely in Europe. When an oak with mistletoe growing on it was discovered, Druids dressed in white robes would come to harvest it on the 6th day after the new moon. One Druid would climb up the oak to where the mistletoe grew, carrying a golden sickle to cut the plant, while the others on the ground below would hold a white cloth stretched out underneath the tree to catch the mistletoe when it fell. Once it was harvested, 2 bullocks would be sacrificed to the Celtic gods, and their meat roasted and shared in a community celebration. For the Druids knew how to make a medicine from mistletoe that, as Pliny wrote, could cure all diseases. Pliny got at least one detail of the ceremony wrong, for gold is a very soft metal, and a sickle made of gold won't cut cardboard, much less the tough stem of a mistletoe plant. The ancient Celts were skilled blacksmiths, however, and it would have been easy for them to make a sickle of steel and then put a thin layer of gilding on the blade, except for the cutting edge, so that it would look like gold. What else Pliny might have gotten wrong, we have no way of knowing, but his account of the ceremony became a source of inspiration for the Druid revival when it began many centuries later. Stonehenge. Nobody knows whether the ancient Druids had anything to do with Stonehenge, the famous ring of standing stones on England's Salisbury Plain. Archaeologists these days believe that the first Celtic peoples came to Britain sometime after 1300 BCE, and Stonehenge was built in several phases, the earliest beginning around 2950 BCE, and the latest ending around 1600 BCE. If the ancient Druids originated among the Celts, they had nothing to do with Stonehenge. If, on the other hand, ancient Druidry had its roots in surviving traditions from the age of the stone circles and was passed on to the Celts after they arrived in northwestern Europe, then it makes sense to say that the ancient Druids were descended from the builders of Stonehenge. Since the origins of the ancient Druids are unknown, we simply can't say. What we know for certain is that Stonehenge and other megalithic structures played an important role in shaping the modern Druid movement that began in the 18th century. Visit any of the old stone circles, and you'll find, as countless Druids have done through the years, that while most churches and other religious structures shut out the world, standing stones direct your attention to the surrounding landscape and the sky above. That experience helped encourage the people who revived the tradition to make Druidry a spiritual path rooted in living nature. It is an important reason why Druids began celebrating their rituals in stone circles, almost as soon as the Druid revival got started, and explains why they began to welcome the summer solstice at Stonehenge as soon as they could get the legal right to do so. Some archaeologists like to insist that there's something wrong with that explanation, but what they've forgotten is that the history of Stonehenge as a sacred place did not end in 1600 BCE. It remains a sacred place today for Druids around the world and for many others who may not call themselves Druids, but who recognize that standing beneath the open sky, surrounded by the mighty stones raised by the ancients, can be as moving and transformative an experience today as it was before the first Celt set foot on Britain's shores. Celtic legends. Among the legacies that remain from the days of the ancient Celts are collections of legends that were written down in the Middle Ages. Most of those survived in Ireland, where Druids lasted longer than anywhere else, and where Christian monks took pride in the legends of their ancestors and copied down the old stories into handwritten books. Three great cycles of those tales come from Ireland. The mythological cycle, which chronicles the settlement of Ireland by many groups of settlers and their gods. The Ulster cycle, which tells the stories of the hero Cuculain and the warriors of the Red Branch. And the Fenian cycle, which collects the stories of the warrior chieftain Finn MacCool and his companions. From Wales came the four branches of the Mabinogi, four tales of magic set before the Roman conquest, and a handful of other ancient stories. Wales and Brittany also kept a far more extensive tradition alive, however. In both countries, folk tales about a war leader of the early Middle Ages were enriched with a great deal of much older material, dating far back into the Celtic past. In the 12th century, Welsh and Breton storytellers recounted these tales to eager listeners in France and England, recasting them in terms of the knightly culture of the time. The war leader turned into King Arthur. His warriors were reframed as the Knights of the Round Table, and the Arthurian legends became one of the great storehouses of Celtic lore and legend under a thin layer of medieval imagery. Many Druids today study these legends to deepen their understanding of Druidry's Celtic roots. Don't make the mistake of thinking them as holy scriptures, however. The closest modern Druids have to scriptures is the natural world itself, which constantly teaches wisdom to those who pay close attention to it. The legends of the ancient Celtic peoples are there to be studied, reflected on, and above all else, enjoyed. Chapter 2. The Druid Revival. In the early years of the 18th century, many people in Great Britain were dissatisfied with the spiritual options that their culture offered them. On the one hand, the churches of the time offered a cold and rationalistic Christianity that replaced personal spiritual experience with blind belief in formal doctrines and obedience to the established social order. On the other, supporters of the newly launched movement of scientific materialism insisted that spirituality was nonsense and nothing existed but dead matter and the void. Faced with a choice between those two options, some people decided to look for a third choice, and one of the things they found was the legend of the ancient Druids. British historians by then had already gathered up everything that the Greek and Roman writers had to say about the Druids of their time, and had begun to study the old Irish lore about Druids. That made it easy for people in the 18th century to envision a tradition similar to that of the ancient Druids, but adapted for the needs of their own time. The idea of a nature spirituality practiced beneath the open sky, recognizing the presence of spirit in the phenomena of nature, was also profoundly appealing to people who had already begun to see the environmental destruction caused by the first waves of the Industrial Revolution. Even though the secrets of the ancient Druids were lost forever, some of these 18th-century spiritual rebels decided to take the same name for themselves and set out to recover or reinvent something like the traditions of the Druids of ancient times. The movement they founded thus came to be called the Druid Revival. No one knows exactly when the Druid Revival began. Certain traditions in today's Druid movement claim that the first Druid organization of modern times was founded in 1717, though no one has yet found solid proof of this. By the 1740s, certainly, the Reverend William Stukeley, an influential early Druid, was holding meetings of an informal Druid society at his home in London. And by the end of the century, Druid groups had been founded in various parts of England, Wales, Ireland, and the newly founded United States of America, where the Society of Ancient Druids was organized in New York State in 1798. Though the Druid movement was small and scattered in those early days, it laid down foundations on which generations of future Druids would build. It also established a tradition that would be central to Druidry ever after, a refusal to burden the movement with dogma and hierarchy. That tradition became central to the revival partly by circumstances, for its early members had many different views about spirituality. From the very beginning, there were Christian Druids, pagan Druids, and pantheist Druids, all of whom somehow managed to get along most of the time. They had also gotten past the habit of thinking that spirituality required belief in a specific set of opinions or obedience to this or that authority figure, and helped Druidry emerge in its modern form as a personal encounter with the presence of spirit in nature. That same vision helped the revival deal with the most important challenge that it faced: the need to create new traditions of teaching and practice. Since the teachings of the ancient Druids had been lost 1,000 years before, the new Druids of the 18th century had very little to work with at first. Scraps of Celtic tradition preserved in old Welsh and Irish literature, borrowings from other spiritual traditions, and personal experience provided the raw materials. Over time, though, various Druid groups and individuals pieced together symbols, rituals, and methods of spiritual practice, and those that worked well were further refined over generations. The resulting openness to innovation and experimentation became a source of strength for the movement. New spiritual movements come and go, but the Druid Revival had staying power. All through the 19th and 20th centuries, Druid organizations of various kinds spread through Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand. Some of the
sample complete. Ready to continue?